Good morning and welcome to Blueprint for Wealth. I'm Wayne Zell, your host of this very fast-paced half hour of special topics and special guests designed to help you realize your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. Blueprint for Wealth is brought to you by the premier law firm of Odin, Feldman & Pittleman, located in Reston, Virginia, but serving the entire D.C. metro area with clients all across the country. If you'd like to know more about OF&P, visit us on the web at ofplaw.com or give us a call at 703-218-2100 to speak with one of our many attorneys in areas as diverse as corporate, business law, divorce, real estate, litigation, international, and intellectual property, among other areas, and real estate. I think I mentioned real estate. Anyway, I also invite you to tune in to my blog, which has articles, audio, and video of interest in tax and estate planning. And you can download some of the audios from past shows on Blueprint for Wealth, or watch some videos of interest, or just read articles on estate, tax, and business planning topics. And lastly, please read my column in the Washington Business Journal entitled Blueprint for Wealth. Today, we're going to conclude our discussion, a very complex discussion, but an interesting one on private equity funds. What's a private equity fund? It's where you take money, invest it into a fund, which may be a limited partnership, that then takes the money and invests it into private companies, portfolio companies that may be in a special industry, technology, real estate, or it may be across a variety of sectors. Now, I'm going to give you an example of how a private equity limited partnership works. I was mentioning last week that when a limited partner or an investor in a private equity fund puts money in, decides to invest, no money changes hands initially. In fact, the limited partner merely agrees to commit a certain amount of money, capital, to a limited partnership. That partnership is managed by general partners. In doing so, the LP, limited partner, signs a legally binding commitment to contribute capital to the fund whenever the GP requests it, up to the point where the limited partner's size of the capital commitment is then reached. For example, let's say we've got a large, fictitious, institutional investor called Global Opportunity Corporation, and that company has agreed to invest with a private equity firm called Rock Street Partners. Rock Street's raising a $1 billion private equity fund, and Global Opportunity agrees to commit $100 million out of that $1 billion to the fund as a limited partner. The fund eventually gets commitments adding up to the $1 billion and additional limited partners besides Global Opportunity. The general partners of Rock Street now have $1 billion in what we call dry powder to deploy. The Rock Street General Partners finds its first deal, which will require, say, a $50 million equity capital investment from Rock Street. It makes a capital call to the limited partners, requiring them to transfer to the general partner an amount of capital equal to their pro rata share of that call. Well, Global Opportunity said it was going to commit 10% of the fund, so it has a $5 million cash call that it has to make and contribute into the fund. A year later, Rock Street does another deal, this time requiring Global Opportunity to send in $10 million. Over a total of 5 years, the investment period that is actually specified in the limited partnership agreement, a total of $100 million is drawn down from Global Opportunity Corporation and invested in various Rock Street deals. Meanwhile, the first investment done by Rock Street turns out to be a huge success, which we all hope is the case in all private equity deals. The general partners have managed to grow the value of this $50 million initial equity investment into $150 million in just 4 years. This progress is only calculated as an unrealized return because the investment has not yet been sold or exited. In other words, none of the partners in the fund have received their money back yet. Happily, after 4 years, Rock Street sells the portfolio company to a major international corporation and gets the $150 million return in the form of cash. This now is counted as a realized return because the investment has been liquidated and the general partners now have cash on hand to distribute out to the limited partners. Because the first deal has generated a profit of $100 million, which is $150 of the proceeds minus the $50 million initial investment, it means that the general partner gets a 20% carried interest or $20 million of distribution out to the general partners. The full $50 million from the initial investment is returned in a series of distributions to the limited partners, including Global Opportunity, along with $80 million in profits after the general partners have taken out their carried interest. For Global Opportunity, this means it gets back its $5 million initial investment, along with profits of $8 million. Remember, $2 million already has been paid out to the general partner as a carried interest. The general partners at Rock Street brag about getting 3x, three times a gross return on the deal. The limited partners in Rock Street also are happy, but are aware that their own overall return is less because of the carried interest and other fees that the general partner has taken out. They also know that this is just one deal in a large collection of investments that are done by the fund, and they hope that the other deals work out as well. If the deals don't work out as well, then the general partner who took out this carried interest may have to face what's called a clawback and recontribute some of the profit back to the private equity fund. The actual formula for determining the principal amount that gets paid out to the partners and the profits that get paid out is something known as a waterfall. Over the life of a fund, which can last as long as 10 to 15 years, the general partners of the $1 billion Rock Street Fund gradually make and then exit all of their investments in the collection of portfolio companies. One investment may be held for 8 years. One might be held for only 9 months. It's a quick flip of the original investment. Eventually, all the investments go through what are called liquidity events, and all the cash proceeds are returned to the partners in the limited partnership in an agreed-upon profit-sharing formula. Some private equity firms actually will distribute profits to the limited partners in the form of publicly traded stock. So if one of the investments went public, they might make an in-kind distribution of those shares out to the investors. This might present problems when the value of the shares decline after they are distributed to the investors. Although there are many different formulas for waterfalls, here's how a waterfall commonly used in the United States works. It's often called a deals realized to date waterfall. When a deal is exited, cash proceeds become available, and these are distributed in a certain priority that's set by the limited partnership agreement. Some of the proceeds are held in reserve. Then, if there's any more cash available, the limited partners are reimbursed for their original investment in the deal. Then, if there's anything left, the proceeds might be used to pay back the limited partners for capital that's used in any deal on that has been written off. In other words, a bad deal that's gone bust. Then, if there's any cash remaining after that, it's used to pay the limited partners for any management fees that they've paid out to the general partner. And then, if there's any cash left after that, the limited partners are paid until they've received a preferred return on investments that they've already made. In most funds today, the preferred return is anywhere from 8 to 12% per year. After this point, if there's anything remaining, the general partner gets to keep the 20% of the net proceeds, which is known as the carried interest. At the end of a fund's life, as I mentioned earlier, a general partner may be subject to what is commonly called a clawback if it turns out that they've overpaid themselves. In other words, if it turns out the GP has actually taken out 21% of the fund's profits after all the investment returns have been calculated. It may be on the hook to pay that 1% back to the limited partners. This can be painful and even impossible if, for example, any of the general partners in question already have spent the money, died, gone through a divorce, or left the firm and gone elsewhere. To avoid these painful clawbacks, some waterfall formulas require that the general partner put the profits, or some of the profits, into an escrow, where the carried interest is temporarily put sort of in a lockbox until a better picture of the fund's performance is known in the future. Private equity funds also charge fees that can materially impact the net return of the limited partner. Typically, a management fee of about 2% of committed capital is usually charged to the limited partner. These fees are designed to pay for the operations of the private equity firm. But for well-established firms with large funds, these fees have gone beyond paying to keep the lights on, so to speak, and really result in tremendous sources of profit and wealth to the general partners. An additional source of fee income to a general partner comes in the form of what is described as a transaction fee or a deal fee. These fees usually see the GP charge its own portfolio company for services rendered. Anyway, private equity funds are complex, but an enormous source of cash for investing in portfolio companies. If you're interested in learning more about investing in private equity funds, or if you'd like to know how private equity funds can invest in your portfolio company, call us at Odin Feldman and Pittleman at 703-218-2100 or visit us on the web at ofplaw.com.